Welcome to the Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our ancient Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if they just might change how we read, or maybe read into, scripture. Last week, we ended with King David, who is called the Lamp of Israel. He is near the end of his reign, so much so that some of his military leaders are telling him, you know, hey, maybe you shouldn't go to war with us because we don't want to lose you. Well, as you turn the page from the book of Samuel into the first book of Kings, we find David actually on his deathbed. And at this point, there seems to be a little bit of confusion over who is going to be his successor. Now, on paper, considering the ways of the world, the law of primogeniture, as we would call it these days, the next logical king would be a man named Adonijah. He is David's next oldest son. He, like Absalom before him, like King Saul long before him, is described as handsome. He is presented in a way that sounds very, very kingly. And he, knowing that his father is on his deathbed, is going about making plans to position himself to become the next king of Israel. We read about him making sacrificial offerings, preparing a feast, and really aligning himself with the military branch of his father's government. But we also see that he is purposely excluding his brothers, especially his young brother Solomon, and the religious factions of King David's government. And so specifically, the prophet Nathan is not involved in everything that Adonijah is doing to pave his own way to become king. And so early in 1 Kings, you see the prophet Nathan going and talking to David's wife Bathsheba and saying, you know, hey, if Adonijah becomes king, then that could potentially be bad for you. He could kill your son. He could kill you. And so we need to go in and we need to talk to David and we need to make sure that Solomon becomes the next king. And so they concoct a plan where Bathsheba goes in there and she tells David, hey, Adonijah is out there doing all this stuff. But don't you remember that you promised me that Solomon, your son Solomon, our son Solomon, he would actually be the next king of Israel? And then Nathan says, I'll follow you. I'll come in after that. I'll confirm everything that you are saying that Adonijah has done. And you know, this is how we'll present it to King David and we'll get Solomon on the throne. They go through, they do this, and really their plan is successful. David agrees. David allows Solomon to take his mule, to go be anointed by Zadok the priest. And then David himself, although he's not able to bow down to his son because he is so frail, he makes it obvious to the nation that Solomon is his chosen successor. What is potentially funny about this story is we don't actually know for sure if David ever did promise Bathsheba that Solomon would be the next king, because that is not recorded anywhere in the book of Samuel. We don't have a story of David stating this is how the line of succession is going to go. And so there's some question there. Is this Nathan the prophet being motivated by God? Being motivated by politics? Maybe he just likes Solomon better. You know, we don't really know what is behind all of it. It's just, it's one of those funny stories where we're just left to kind of sit back and wonder, was this David's actual plan? Or, you know, is David in his old age? He's obviously very, very sick. Is he being manipulated by the people who are around him? We don't know. But the result is Solomon becomes the next king of Israel. And the years under Solomon are absolutely without question, the golden years of the nation of Israel. Since Solomon is so famously wealthy and wise, he rules for 40 years, it might be a little bit surprising that Israel as a nation isn't known as the House of Solomon. It's known as the House of David. And we see that designation among all sorts of nations in the ancient Near East. The beginning of a line of successors very often is known as the house of whoever that first king was. So we have the house of David, and then of course Solomon is his successor, and then the nation, the southern kingdom of Israel, which we will get into the separate kingdoms next week. The southern kingdom of Israel, which is made up of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, that part of Israel continues to be known as the house of David for hundreds of years beyond this point. In the north, that is very frequently referred to as the nation of Omri. I'm sorry, the house of Omri. So you have the northern Israel is the house of Omri. Southern Israel is the house of David. Well, this is widely known. And what is particularly strange for theologians and for archaeologists, at least up until 1994, is that even though this was well known by the world, there is no extra biblical evidence prior to 1994 of the house of David. In fact, David's name is not even found written anywhere in stele from surrounding nations, from the Assyrians. We will talk about them in a few weeks, from the Egyptians, from Nebuchadnezzar. Anytime you have conquering kings, they'll take these giant pieces of stone, and they will write into it the glories of their exploits, all of the kings that they conquered, all the nations that they conquered, how many people they killed, how large the conquered armies were, all of these kinds of things. They're probably inflated a little bit in their descriptions. Well, in all of these stelae over all of this time, David's name doesn't appear. Well, so in 1994, archaeologists who were digging at a site called Tel Dan found what they would call the Tel Dan stele. And as I like to joke, archaeologists, not super creative people, which I think is really a very, very good thing. So it's a stele that was found at Tel Dan. So they call it the Tel Dan stele. And on this piece of rock is written the exploits of an Aramean king. And on this, he describes that he has had a victory over two of his southern neighbors, the king of Israel and the king of the house of David. It is written in really neat Aramaic characters. And in this stele, we can read that king, although he's boasting for himself, he's also giving the honor to his god, Hadad. And he talks about how he vanquished actually several thousand Israelite and Judahite horsemen and charioteers before he personally dispatched all of his royal opponents. Well, this stele, we didn't find it, or archaeologists didn't just find it. It wasn't we. I think I was 12 when it was found. But the archaeologists who uncovered it, they didn't find it in the center of a courtroom somewhere. It wasn't found in what we called a primary context. It was actually found in a secondary context. So many years later, that particular stele was broken, and those pieces were reused in a wall that was being built later. So we don't know, because it's broken, we don't have the whole thing. We're not exactly sure which king this was, but theologians and a lot of archaeologists tentatively agree that it was probably about the campaign of King Hazael of Damascus, and that this is a description of his exploits and his interactions with Jehoram of Israel and Ahaziah of Judah. And these stories are retold for us in 2 Kings 12. Now, 2 Kings 12 has a little bit of a different version of the story, in that it doesn't say that they were actually conquered by the king of Damascus. It says that Israel ends up paying tribute to him. So, you know, you have slightly different versions, but that is what we think is happening in the Tel Dan stele. Well, so up until 1994, there is this problem for archaeologists and for theologians. Why don't we have David's name somewhere? Why don't we have Solomon's name somewhere other than in the Bible? And so scientists, they came up with this theory that is called the low chronology. And the low chronology basically states that Kings David and Solomon, and depending on who you're talking to, some will even include Saul in this, they say that they didn't actually exist, that ancient Israel was never actually a unified nation, that it was 12 tribes that over time worked together, and then you ended up going straight from the 12 tribes to the divided kingdom of Israel. So 10 of the tribes ended up forming the northern kingdom of Israel, and then Judah and Benjamin got together and formed the southern kingdom of Israel, which is also often called Judah or the house of David, as we were just saying. So the Tel Dan Stela is something now that is used to almost debunk the low chronology. With all artifacts, not everyone agrees that the Tel Dan Stela actually states House of David. Some people will read it in different ways because it was found in a secondary context instead of a primary context. We don't learn as much from it as maybe we would like to, but we do have it found in Tel Dan, which is the very northernmost part of the northern kingdom, very likely to have come into contact with the king of Aram. Everything fits together for it really to make sense. And anyway, it's the first extra biblical evidence of King David that has been found in the world. Well, so getting back to King Solomon, he was a king during really peaceful times. And as I think I mentioned last week, when a nation is at peace, then it can spend time on infrastructure and art and just developing better lives for the people who lived there. And so Solomon primarily is known as a great builder. And in the Bible, we read about three of his royal cities that he built: Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. And these cities at the time were of strategic importance to Israel because of where they're located. Their borders are near waterways, or they're near really, really popular trade routes. And in the excavation of these cities, which you can go and tour them today, and I encourage you to if you're ever able to go, you see that the defenses that were built there were absolutely top of the line. Solomon here probably roughly the first time, he expands the defenses so that the gates that you enter into when you're going into the city, they're no longer two chambers or four chambers. This time they're six chamber gates. And that indicates several things. One, that he's really, really fortifying these cities. He's making, you know, the walls are thicker, the walls are taller, the gates are bigger. He is making sure that the treasures and the people and the animals and everything that lives within those cities are going to be safe and protected. They're also, as far as the military is concerned, they're going to be easily mobilized if ever someone does come and attack, or if Israel needs to go out and attack someone. So these cities were built very, very strategically. But also with those gates, he is not neglecting the daily function, the daily lives of everyone who's living there at the time, because as you'll remember, gates weren't just swinging doors to let people come in or to keep people from going out or vice versa. Gates, that's where civic activity happened. Merchants would sell their wares there. Merchants would store their wares there. Judges would sit there. Judges from the period of the judges, or you know, even later, decisions would be made. People would argue cases and everything there. And so the gates were really where civic life happened. And so he's building these big, massive cities, not just to fortify the nation for times of war that would most certainly come, but also to improve the lives of the people who were living there for his growing population. Well, if you go and visit specifically Megiddo, you're gonna maybe notice that Solomon isn't mentioned, at least not as far as I could find. Last time I was there, I obviously knew about the low chronology, but when you go there and visit all of the everything in the visitor center, at least when I was last there in 2019, it actually credits the building of Megiddo to Ahab. And so that's what happens with the low chronology, is that David and Solomon drop out of the chronology entirely. And then those years just get collapsed down on top of each other. And so then you have the building projects that the Bible credits to Solomon actually going to the kings who followed him. So in this case, King Ahab is one who is actually credited with building Megiddo. I and my advisor, Lawrence Steger, and many, many people do not follow the low chronology. We're a little more traditional in the way that we date the Bible and understand it, because I do think it's really important for us to remember that Samuel and Kings, for Christians and for Jews, it is a sacred text. It is a holy text. But for ancient Israel, when it was being written, this was also a historical text. These were the stories that they were laying down for themselves, in the ways that the Egyptians have their reliefs all over their buildings, in the ways that the Assyrians and later the Neo-Babylonians and all of them created those stela. This was a historical record also, which I think can be easy to forget when we 2,000-3,000 years later are reading it as a spiritual text. Remember, back then it was also historical for these people. So when you go to visit Israel and you go to Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer, you'll see that maybe Solomon's biggest building projects were these cities, but that's not his most famous. Solomon, bar none, is most famous for building the first temple at Jerusalem. So prior to him building the temple, prior really to David bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, all of the Israelites would worship God at what were called high places. And we're going to talk about those more next week and really in the weeks to come, because they're going to become an issue. But once the temple is built, according to what God said, any worship that happened anywhere other than within the temple complex actually becomes illegal. All worship of God is supposed to happen at this temple. Well, according to our Bibles, the first temple, it was built by King Solomon somewhere around 950. And that process is described in 1 Kings 5-9. It gives all the credit to Solomon. But then if you go to Chronicles, which Chronicles was written later, we're going to talk a lot more about it in the last episode of this season. Chronicles actually gives David credit for designing the buildings. And so you'll often hear that David was the architect of the temple, but Solomon was the builder. And admittedly, to say Solomon was the builder, I don't think he was out there on his hands and knees stacking stones to do it. Of course, he was the general contractor for the building. Or my husband works for a general contractor. Maybe that's not even right. Maybe Solomon was the developer of the temple, if you want to think of it that way. That was really the way he worked with this. Well, so what the Bible describes for us is a structure that is what archaeologists call a long room style of a building. It sort of reminds me of what in the South we would call a shotgun house, where you can walk in the front door and you can see all the way down a long hall to the back door of the house. And the idea being, if you had a shotgun, it would go from one end of the house to the other. I'm not saying it's the most elegant description, but you know what I'm saying. So it's a long room style. And within that, at the beginning, you have the entryway, and there are two columns that may have been freestanding or may have been supporting something else. The Hebrew is a little bit difficult to interpret, but there are two columns named Boaz and Jachin. Then you enter into a main hall, and that's where some of the rituals took place. And then behind that, and elevated slightly, is the Holy of Holies. And within the Holy of Holies would have sat the Ark of the Covenant, which was God's throne, God's footstool on earth. And so God would have been there as vapor, as smoke in that space over the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark was his footstool. Then you have this building, which is not a very, very large building, but then it is surrounded on three sides by chambers. And we don't exactly know what the chambers were used for. The thought is maybe they were lots of different rooms that would have been just necessary rooms for the Levites who worked there. So maybe storage, maybe sleeping quarters, maybe cafeteria, you know, that sort of thing. But there were some sort of rooms that were around three sides of them. And then outside of that, you had a courtyard. And And in that courtyard would be where the large sacrifices would have happened. And then there's an additional courtyard outside of that. And so when you think about the temple, it's not just that three-room building with the necessary rooms around it, but it's actually the entire temple complex that he would have built there. Well, so the materials are said to have come from two Phoenician cities that were outside of Israel. The wood comes from Tyre, and the stones come from Gebal. Both of these are in modern-day Lebanon, and they are right there on the Mediterranean coast. So it's a little odd to me on the surface that here is Solomon building a temple for his people. I would sort of expect him to use all of the raw materials from within Israel, which sort of begs the question, why? Why did he outsource his materials? And one thought is that maybe these people, the Phoenicians, they were sort of the contractors of choice when it came to temple building at this time. Because in other cities, Tel Tainat, which was in Phoenicia, and also in Ein Dara, which was in Aram, both of those are about 40 miles from each other, and they have temples that are architecturally similar to what we see described in the Bible. Even the decorations of those are really, really similar. They both include the cherubim, which there are cherubim that are on top of the Ark of the Covenant. There are also cherubim that are along the gilded walls of the temple, woven into the fabrics of the temple. And cherubim, lest ye be imagining a little fat baby or something like that, cherubim were actually monsters. They were composite creatures with the wings of eagles and the bodies of lions, and the heads vary depending on which bit of scripture you're talking about, but cherubim were these monstrous guardian creatures that whenever they appeared in ancient Israel, they were an indication that God was near. But similar creatures actually appeared in other temples in the region too. Well, so when you're just reading the text of the Bible, it can be difficult to picture what is being described there. Because first off, we've never exactly seen what's being described there. Also, some of the Hebrew words that are used, not just for the construction of the temple, but also for a lot of the furnishings that are there, are Hebrew words that aren't really used anywhere else. And translators can't be 100% certain what some of these details actually mean. And so this is where archaeology is really great. And this is where those temples and other places can be really, really helpful. Because Solomon's temple, the first temple, the temple complex, what would be destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. We will get to that later on in the season. So we don't have Solomon's temple left. When you go to Jerusalem and you visit the Western Wall, that is actually the foundation of the extended courtyard for the second temple. The second temple was built by Ezra, and then later under Herod the Great, he came in and he expanded that temple complex. And so that wall is actually the foundation of what Herod added around the time Jesus was born. So really a 1,000 years almost after Solomon's temple, that is what the Western Wall actually is. It has nothing to do with Solomon's temple. The materials or anything don't. Well, so in Ein Dara, we see a temple that is also this long room style. It also has three buildings that are within it. And it just helps us sort of envision what's there. Ein Dara was a really, really impressive site. And if you've ever seen images of it, probably the ones that will stick with you the most are as you're entering into the temple, there are these giant footprints that were carved into the stone there. And they're so big. And the idea is that they are the footprints of their god, potentially Hadad, who we were just talking about at the beginning of this episode. There are these giant footprints there. And if those footprints actually matched up anatomically to a god, that god would have been 65 feet tall. So it helps you sort of envision the scale of what was happening there. That temple was built around 1300, and it remained in use for 550 years until 740. Well, The ruins were there. It got excavated. Even the ruins themselves were quite impressive. You could see so many of the decorations, the facades, cherubim, who were still in perfect condition, were there. Well, on January 22nd of 2018, the Turkish army bombed it. And it left two craters that are in the temple where the threshold, where those carved footprints actually were situated. And because of the way the explosions happened, it took out the walls, it took out the floors, it took out the decorations, the entrance. It's really just rubble now. And so there's disagreement about who exactly did it or why they did it. And so I'm actually putting some links in the show notes, as I always do, for you to do a little more investigation. If you click on that link, it's really great. It's an investigation that was done by ASOR, and they went in. There's photographs of the site before the attack. There's photographs after. And then there's also some description of what they think happened based on satellite imagery and the forensic research that they did to try to figure out what happened to this tell. So the Ayn Dara was an incredible place. It really did help archaeologists and theologians understand a little bit better what Solomon's Temple might have looked like. And it is a real tragedy that it is not there for us to visit anymore. King Solomon was busy building his cities and building his temple, amassing wealth, making trades with all these other nations. He also was very famous for marrying many foreign women, having relationships with foreign women. And there is the tradition that he had a liaison with the Queen of Sheba, who is described as one of the most beautiful women in the world. Well, the Bible actually tells us very, very little about her. And what we think we know about the Queen of Sheba, such as her beauty and actually her land of origin, is actually the result of traditions, not biblical text. And a lot of it comes from an Ethiopian Orthodox writing called The Glory of the Kings. And it is in The Glory of the Kings that it is said that the Queen of Ethiopia went and met Solomon. She gave birth to Solomon's first son. And then Solomon sent his son back to Ethiopia and sent the Ark of the Covenant with him. They made a replica. A replica went into the temple. The original went with the Queen of Sheba's son back into Ethiopia. There's a lot that's potentially funny with that story. Primarily, why would the king of Israel, who was God's representative on earth, in addition to just being king of the people, why would he choose to take the Ark of the Covenant out of the temple? I mean, it's curious. This is not a biblical story. This is a traditional story from The Glory of the Kings. So it's not just curious that this story says that the Ark of the Covenant left. It's also curious that Ethiopia is identified with Sheba, because there was in antiquity a kingdom of Saba, S-A-B-A, Saba, and it is in modern day Yemen. It is just across the Red Sea, actually from Ethiopia. And there is evidence from archaeologists who've worked in those areas that Ethiopia and Saba actually traded with each other a lot. They culturally influenced each other quite a bit. And that cultural influence began as early as 800 BCE. With Solomon, we're looking at more like 950, so 150 years prior to the time when we know there was influence between Egypt and Saba. But, you know, I mean, within 100, 150 years, there was some cultural blending going on. And of course, obviously, the cultural blending between these could have been happening before we have evidence of it. That's the thing about archaeology. You have to keep digging. We have what we have, but we can't just assume that what we have is all that we will ever have. And that's part of what makes the field so wonderful and so exciting, and part of what is humbling about it too, because we can't go around assuming that we know absolutely everything, because there's stuff like the Tel Dan Stela that, you know, maybe hasn't been found yet. Well, so there are texts later on where some Ethiopian kings actually call themselves rulers of Saba. And it doesn't appear that they actually did govern in Saba, but because of these interactions and because of the way these two molded together, it's possible that these cultural influences made it make sense for the kings who were in Ethiopia to also say that they were in charge of or maybe politically influencing Saba. So somewhere in all of that is probably how we get the stories of the Queen of Sheba and how we get her being associated with Ethiopia, which just on the very, very surface doesn't seem to make sense with what we know historically. Well, we know the Queen of Sheba was wealthy. The Bible tells us that she was impressed by Solomon's wisdom, and she could have traveled to Jerusalem from the literal kingdom of Sheba of Saba, or she could have been a queen ruling in Ethiopia who had Saba within her sphere of influence. And so maybe it wasn't quite a literal title, but it could have still been accurate at the time. All of this is just very fuzzy and something that we need to think about. And it's in places like this where maybe we don't fully understand the history. We don't know all of it yet. Not enough has been discovered. Where for me, as far as scripture goes, I just go to the Bible and, you know, what does it say? Let's start with that and then realize that everything else that we add to, everything else that we say about those verses, those are things that we're adding. Those are our opinions. Those are our theories that we're adding to it. And some of it may be contextual and historically accurate. And, you know, some of it, we may still be waiting for the details to come out of the ground. Well, so today you're probably aware that the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, they claim to this day that they have the Ark of the Covenant in Lalibela, which is a church in Aksum. And the struggle there is they say that they have it, but no one is allowed to go inside and see it. So no one has seen it. And this is actually one of several theories as to what may have happened to the Ark of the Covenant. In the Bible, the Ark of the Covenant just disappears. It just quits being mentioned. But there are lots of traditions that developed around it. And we'll talk about some of those as we get further down into the season, as we get to Jeremiah, as we get to some of the other prophets, and especially when we go in to talk about Nebuchadnezzar and the fall of Jerusalem. We'll mention it a lot then. But as we close today, I hope that you will think about Solomon and think about his reign as really the golden era of Israel. It is when Israel's borders were at their largest, when ancient Israel was at its biggest, when it was growing and developing, when it had the respect of all of the nations around them. And it was really just the perfect golden time that during the exile, the Book of Chronicles and prophets and everybody would tell the Jews to look back on and to remember the house of David, to remember Solomon, to remember the wisdom of Solomon. These two men are really central to the history of ancient Israel and the memory of ancient Israel. Join me next week when Solomon's reign ends and Israel divides into the northern and southern kingdoms. The 10 northern tribes, after only one generation of unity around Jerusalem, find themselves separated from God's temple, unable to worship Him properly, and heavily influenced by their pagan neighbors. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yurimkiv. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.